thanks to our title sponsor, National University. National University is committed to supporting veterans, active duty personnel, and military families through flexible online courses and master's and doctoral programs in high-demand fields, providing excellent career advancement opportunity. National University is a yellow ribbon school that proudly accepts the post-9/11 GI Bill and goes the extra mile by offering additional assistance to cover expenses that may not be covered by the GI Bill. To learn more, visit nu.edu/veteran. Well, happy holidays, everyone, and welcome to the Fighter Pilot Podcast, the internet radio show that explores the fascinating world of air combat, the aircraft, the weapon systems, and most importantly, the people. I am your host, Vincent Aiello, call sign Jello, and if you follow the show and have been listening lately, you know we've been keeping pretty busy. We had 3 episodes in November we called Bomber Month, then we had the E2 Hawkeye episode earlier this month, and we've got the holidays bearing down on us and the episode 100 celebration, not to mention in early 2021, episodes 101 through 106 are going to be on the Century Series fighters from the 50s and 60s. And so there's a lot going on, and we're going to take a breather. But we can't leave you hanging, so we've got a fix for you out there. We have a really awesome discussion coming up. It's from our Happy Hour series. Now, if you're not familiar with Happy Hours, these are more casual discussions we have with various characters and military aviation circles. We record on Zoom so that there's a visual aspect, and unfortunately that means the audio quality suffers a little bit. But what we do is we take these and we air them on our Patreon page as exclusive content for listeners who financially support the show. And it's just a really awesome perk for them. I think you would love it if you check it out. Anyway, this particular happy hour is with retired Air Force Colonel Cesar Rodriguez, call sign Rico. And he has some incredible stories from his days flying the F-15 in operations Desert Shield, Desert Storm, and Allied Force. If you enjoyed our Desert Storm MGKiller episode with Mongo, then I think you're really going to enjoy this discussion. Yes, it's about the aircraft and the weapon systems, but I think you're really going to love the people in Rico's talk. So without any further ado, let's get to it. This is just an excerpt of it, and I'll come back and meet you at the end before we sign off for the day. All right, here we go. All right. Hello, Rico. How are you?
Jello, how are you doing, my friend?
I'm doing great. All right. Welcome to Happy Hour. Let's see. What have you got?
I've got Tecate.
Oh, well, that is appropriate. You're down in Tucson, right?
That's right.
Okay. I've got a local Coronado Brewing Company Islander IPA.
Very nice.
So cheers, sir.
Cheers. Salud.
Oh, man. I have to tell you, I've been looking forward to this, but I've been so busy. I wanted to do some research on you, but the only thing I know leading into this conversation is Top Gun Maverick trailer begins with Ed Harris saying a bunch of things about Tom Cruise. And one of them, he says, the only man to shoot down 3 MiGs in the last 30 years. And that's not true, is it?
Well, it's definitely not Tom Cruise.
Well, I know, but don't we know somebody here who has done something like that?
Yeah, I have been credited with 3 air-to-air kills in the last 30 years, post-Vietnam era.
Wow.
And so, yeah, I heard that trailer, and I actually said, oh, they're going to say my name. and then they screwed it up.
Yeah, exactly. Well, you're just as good-looking as Tom Cruise, if I may say so, sir, but anyway, all right. Well, that's awesome. Let's talk about it. And I think I have a book over here with at least one of your stories, but you have kills in the F-15, which is behind you there. Nice background. Thank you.
Yeah. So courtesy of some very, very close friends that I can't reveal their name because they're actually in combat operations today.
Oh, wow.
Once a year, I get a nice postcard from the dedicated crew chief and the pilot whose name is on my jet. So 114 is right behind me. She is currently flying combat operations over the CENTCOM AOR.
And that's the one you got some kills in?
That's the one I got 2 of my kills in on the 19th and the 26th of January in 1991.
Okay.
And then my third kill was in 169 when I was with the Grim Reapers. We called her the Love Machine. And and that was on the 24th of March of 1999.
Okay. So for our non-history students in the crowd, 1991 was Desert Storm. 1999
Correct.
Was Allied Force?
Correct. Operation Allied Force, NATO's first air campaign.
All right. All right. So let's start at the beginning. Where are you from?
So I'm an Army brat, born in El Paso, Texas. Traveled all around the world, mostly South and Central America with my dad.
Okay.
Myself and three other brothers and sisters. And then from El Paso, Texas, that's when I joined. I went to the Citadel and then went to the Air Force from there. Graduated from the Citadel in 81.
Okay. And you knew you wanted to fly, or did you stumble into it? We've had people on the Fighter Pilot Podcast, believe it or not. It's like, yeah, I didn't want to fly, but they had an opening, so I put in for it. It was our F-35 guest. It was really funny. But as long as I knew I wanted anything, I wanted to fly. But what about you?
No, flying was literally not my reason for coming out of high school or going to college. I was following in my dad's footsteps coming out of high school thinking Army. And so when I went to the Citadel, I started in the Army ROTC program. And then my roommate and best friend from the Citadel, Jim Myers, who's actually still serving in the Navy as a chaplain. Oh. Jim is responsible for not only corrupting me on a late Friday, very, very late Friday rendezvous through downtown Charleston, but he's also responsible for waking me up the next morning. And then him and I and all of the rest of the sophomores, we went out and took the tests for the Army, Navy, Air Force, and Marine Corps aviation programs.
Okay.
And then the results of that was that I did very, very well on the Air Force test. And then the Air Force turned around and said, hey, why don't you come over and join Air Force ROTC? We'll give you a 2-year run scholarship. And then if you pass the physical, we'll send you to flight school. And at that point, that's literally the first time I ever thought of flying as something to do once I graduate.
All right. So you were an Army brat. You went to the Citadel. Air Force wanted you. I can see where all this is going. And of course, we know the story anyway. So you go to flight school. You do sufficiently well. Do you pick Eagles right away, or do you do a FAPE, I guess they call it, or what do you do?
No, I actually I miraculously completed flight school. Didn't do very well in the first phase of it. As you can imagine, instruments was a complete foreign object to me. So T-37 phase was, you know, there's times when your golf instructor tells you you should just give up the game of golf. There was a couple folks in flight suits who were already wearing wings who said, you know, this may not be the right thing for you. And I said, no, sorry, dude, I'm not giving it up.
That's right.
T-37s was a little bit of a rough start. T-38s, I was lucky enough to get an instructor, former F-4 pilot, Wheels Wheeler, was my instructor. And he sat me down on day one and said, what do you want to do? And I said, I want to go fly fighters. And my seatmate next to me, he says, I want to go fly 141s. And the other guy said, hey, I think I want to stick around and be a T-37 or T-38 IP or a FAPE. Mm-hmm. And then he very quickly said, well, I don't know what I'm going to do for you guys because I'm not a heavy pilot and I'm not a fan of being a FAPE or an IP here. But Rico, you and I are going to sit together and we're going to walk this path. And so a long hill climbed together with Wheels, and I was able to select an A-10 when the draw came down for my drop.
No kidding.
Yeah.
Okay.
So I started out in the A-10.
All right. Did you actually go fly it, or did you get diverted? Or again, I don't know anything about you, I'm sorry to say.
Yeah, I flew it for 2 years.
Okay.
Went to Holloman for fighter lead-in, and then went to Davis-Monthan for A-10 training. And then while I was at Davis-Monthan, I had an assignment to Alex, Louisiana. And one of my partners in the class had an assignment to Suwon, Korea. And his wife was getting ready to have a baby. So Haas and I made a drug deal. I told him I'd take Korea if he took Alex. Alex was perfect for him because his wife was from Eastern Texas.
Okay.
And then, so I went to Korea and started out in the hog down there. Hmm. And what was normally a 1-year assignment turned out to be a 2-year assignment because everybody, we had just built that squadron literally from scratch. Everybody arrived almost at the same time. So everybody was going to PCS at the same time. And so my squadron commander said, hey, you know, you've been here a lot for a full year. You've done a lot of good things as a lieutenant. If we upgrade you to IP and make you a, you know, mission commander and everything else, would you stay around as a for another year? And I said, sure, I'll take that that job any day. And so in the course of 2 years, I accumulated a little over almost 900 hours in the A-10.
Holy cow.
I was as a lieutenant, I was the DETCO for four deployments down to Cope Thunder in the Philippines. And then so I flew my tail off when I was there at Suwon.
We all did. Yeah, I mean, guys are lucky to get 150 hours a year right now. That's 450 hours a year. Holy smokes.
Yeah, we had no real, there was no real control, if you will, to the flying schedule. As long as the Army put out an ATO up north in P-518, we supported it. And sometimes we'd go 20 or 30 days in a row without stopping. And then we would, you know, stand down for 3 days. The maintenance team was obviously awesome to keep that kind of an ops tempo going. Mm-hmm. And we'd stand down and then we'd start flying again, pick up the ATO and there off we went.
Wow. Well, obviously what I'm really hoping to get to is the stories of these shoot downs, but I just have to ask you on the A-10, I mean, come on, how was that gun?
That gun is pretty badass. And, you know, there are many of folks who would both on the ground and unfortunately not with real bullets, but with video bullets or HUD film. There are many of folks who have found themselves inside of the lethal range of the gun with a pipper track, thinking that the A-10 couldn't have done that. But when you now that they have lead computing sights and everything, it's very clear that even as slow as you're going, when you get those 30-millimeter mics out in front of the whatever airplane you're going, that metal will rip you to pieces.
Oh man.
And so, the A-10 gun is pretty amazing. What's really amazing is you don't feel it at all in the cockpit.
Oh, wow.
I actually felt the 20-millimeter gun in the F-15 more than I felt the A-10 30-millimeter gun. And the gun was literally, you know, between your legs. The barrel was, you know, right there. So yeah, you thought you'd feel it more, but you never got anything except the only thing you could tell that you had shot the gun was you'd look at your G meter and it would spike in both the positive and the negative because of the hypersonics or the sonic booms of the gun itself. But
that's crazy.
It's a pretty amazing weapon.
Yeah. Yeah. Our A-10 guest on the show, it's been over a year, I want to say, Supa. He was also from Tucson, as it turns out, but I guess you have A-10 units based down there. But, you know, we have this structure on the Fighter Pilot Podcast when we do our aircraft series. Okay, what was it designed to do? What does it do well? Blah, blah, blah. But that was a fun one because I said, all right, screw all that, Supa. Tell me about the gun. And we talked about the nose being, or I should say the nose wheel being offset and the rate of fire and the rounds and the depleted uranium and everything else. So, I don't have a lot of regrets, but it would have been fun to, in a, you know, Groundhog Day life, if I could go back and fly that thing for a tour, that'd be pretty amazing. But I guess what I really want to know next is how on earth, there's not too many guys that go from A-10s to F-15s, are there?
No, actually, not many. You know, there was many of the leadership team at Holloman who questioned my sanity and my, my logic, my thinking is that why the hell are you asking for an F-15 out of Holloman? You know, you're going to get whatever you want. And I said, well, I wanted to fly an F-15 from the very get-go. I want to do it again, try it. And sure enough, got an F-15, got it to Eglin, and I went to Tyndall for F-15 training.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. The bad thing was, you know, if I could have gone through an entire B course, that would have been pretty cool.
They gave me what
they called the TX course,
okay,
which is much less than the number of hours that you would get in a B course. So it really was a very steep learning curve for me, and there was literally some days when the drool cup felt like the entire cockpit. I just couldn't figure out which end was up. But, you know, I had some really good instructors who said, hey, Rico, slow it down. You know, one step at a time. Let's get this right. Let's get this right. And then I'll be honest with you, that's when I truly became a fan and a believer that you can teach a monkey how to fly a jet, because I spent a lot of time in the simulator late at night, and the sim guys at Tyndall were like going, Rodriguez, what the hell are you doing here again? I go, hey, I need to figure out what this bit thing does, you know, because I know what the button is, or where the button is. I just don't know what it's doing.
Yeah.
And so I would go spend hours in the sim. Yeah.
What year did you first fly the F-15 or go to Tyndall then?
1980, the fall of 88.
Okay. So by the time Desert Storm kicks off, you're not a new pilot by any stretch, but also you've got a couple of years in the Eagle at that point. I mean, do you go to a deploying squadron after your training, or what do you do?
Yeah. So I went to Eglin with the 58th Fighter Squadron down at Eglin, the Guerrillas. And Paco Geisler was a squadron commander. World famous F-15 and a Red Eagle kind of guy.
Okay.
And he literally was handpicking people from various places, weapons school, 422. We had Chuck McGill come in from the Marine Corps. I mean, we had a stud team of instructors and weapons officers. And it wasn't that he knew we were going to war. He just didn't want anywhere we went. He didn't want us to be going there to be viewed as the second-rate citizens. We were going there to win, to kick ass, to take no names.
Nice.
And move on. And so he built a very, very solid team, of which I was lucky enough to join. And of course, you know, the lessons that you learn when you fly a 0.8 mission, but you debrief for 6 hours, you get to be, you start to learn.
Oh, yeah.
or you get walked out the door.
Yeah.
So in that era, the door was still a possibility.
I'm so glad you said that, because one of the things I do on the Fighter Pilot Podcast is try to convince the listeners whose only experience maybe besides the show is Hollywood, that it's not anything like Hollywood, because if it was, nobody would go see the movie. So we have these enormously drawn out, laborious, detailed debriefs of every little thing we did. What were we thinking? How can we do it better next time? And if you're lucky enough, you can go out and do it right away. But otherwise, you may wait a day or two, and then you finally get to go out. But yeah, it's painful. I was at Top Gun, so I know the drill. So, all right.
Yeah, and you know, I use the analogy too, and even in business today, that the hardest part of closing a deal should be what you do to get ready for the deal. Mm. And so when I do red team reviews with my team as we're getting ready to go into contract negotiations or anything like that, you know, I play the mean, bad customer who's just going to take, is not going to take anything for an answer except what they want. And, you know, people get really, you know, mad and pissed off. And they go, hey, hold on a second. This is to get you better, so that when you walk into the real fight, okay, or the real negotiation, you're in a better position. You're thinking on your feet as opposed to reacting with your emotion. And that's kind of how I correlate the debrief.
Yeah.
Is, you know, there was times in the debrief when it really felt like the only answer was to start crying, but you know, that wouldn't have gone over very well. So.
Well, they say there's no crying in baseball. I would say there's no crying in air combat either. But no, you're right. You were chair flying effectively, right? You were what-ifing, we would call it, and all these other things. But I think the debrief is important too, particularly, now I don't even know what you do or the application you were talking about, but I'd be willing to bet, knowing you and I are cut from the same cloth as so many people who have experiences like ours do, I bet if you don't get the deal, even though you chair flew it, when you get back, I'm guessing you take your team and you debrief what happened, don't you? You say,
oh yeah, we debrief it to the NATSAS and try and figure out how did we miss something.
That's right.
You know, did we not do our competitive intelligence properly and somebody underbid us, or did we say something wrong in the presentation that made our story look less valuable to the customer?
Yeah.
Same thing, and you know, the average industry guy brushes it off, win or loss. They kind of brush it off and go, hey, lesson learned. Well, off you go. I put together a bigger binder of the loss than I did of the win.
Right.
So that nobody repeats the mistakes that we did.
Yeah. Willie Driscoll, I'm guessing you know who he is. He's got a book out, Peak Performance Under Pressure, and he talks about postmortems and debriefs. And again, I think the natural inclination, if anyone's going to spend any time, is to figure out what went wrong. But a lot of times, it's good also to say, hey, we got it. We chair flew it. We expected to get it, and we got it. But did we get it for the reasons we thought? Did we do everything the way we wanted to? And so I think debriefs, I've been contemplating writing. I do a little writing on the side for this show. I've got a little blog called Musings, and I've been contemplating doing one on the benefit of debriefs, because I don't think in normal day-to-day living, a lot of people do it. And I think it's starting to show up more in business, but it's certainly something we did in our military careers. I know that.
Yeah. And, you know, from red flag to Top Gun debriefs to one-on-one BFM debriefs, every one of those is a building block to getting to the next step.
Right.
And if you don't really take it to heart, if you don't take those lessons and apply them, then, you know, one of the things that I tell people, you know, that I get asked a lot is, so how did you feel when you went to combat? And I said, I'll be honest with you. The scariest part of the whole drill was stepping to the jet, knowing that there's going to be live weapons on the airplane. And when you took off and someone said, master arm hot, you know, something was going to be coming off the jet. That was the scariest part. Everything else, you know, when you start doing the check-in, when you start looking at doing your radar discipline, the radar search, all of that, if you did it the right way and you debriefed it the right way and you set up those habit patterns, that part became pretty much a cakewalk, if you will.
Yeah. Well, I don't know about you, Rico. The few times the chips were down for me, and it sounds like you had more opportunities than I did. We'll get to that. But I would say my biggest fear, and I'm not trying to sound stoic or brave or anything else, my biggest fear wasn't so much the physical harm to me. It was I didn't want to screw up. I didn't want to forget to arm up and try to pull the trigger. I didn't want to make myself look bad or, God forbid, put my wingman in a situation or, good grief, get him shot down or her. So for me, it was, I didn't want to screw up more than anything when the chips were down.
I said a prayer for every mission that I flew in combat, and the final words were, please God, don't let me F it up.
I'll tell you this real quick, and again, this is more about you, but part of the workups we do in the Navy is we'll sit off the coast of whichever coast we were based on. In my case, it was off the coast of San Diego, and we did this enormously long, complex strike from the ship all the way up the state of California into Nevada, and we were dropping those laser-guided training rounds, those little blue fake laser-guided weapons, and I forgot to unbox SIM, and so it didn't come off. And I go all the way back, you know, the whole mission's like 2.5-3 hours. And I was the training officer in the squadron. I was a Top Gun graduate. And I just hung my head. But then I also stood up and I said, this is what I did. And if I can do it, anyone can do it. And this is the mistake I made. And this is what I learned. And here's my slice of humble pie. And it's delicious. But I didn't try to brush it off. Or I didn't jettison the thing over the water pretending it was fine. I lived up to it. And it sucked, but that was the most memorable one for me.
Well, you know, and that ties into the debrief. You know, I had a phenomenal group of weapons officers and instructor pilots, and to the man, they all, as the debrief was going on, they also were as critical of themselves as they were of my performance, and vice versa. You know, if it was good, they was, you know, and so that really made the debrief a truly a two-way dialogue. But that's that, you know, I'll be the first to tell you that wasn't the norm. The fighter community has both good and bad from the standpoint of wanting to be thick-skinned, but at the same time, doesn't, you don't want to air your dirty laundry. I was blessed. I was lucky. I had some really talented dudes, and they were as hard on themselves as they were hard on me.
You know, and that's a funny statement, not funny, haha, but when I started this podcast, it's been over 3 years now, I don't know, whatever it's been. People would tell me, like, quit pointing out your errors and mistakes. And I still do it. I just recorded something right before we got on here. And it was for another happy hour thing that I was going to air out for everyone. And I said, oh, you know, you'll hear me making a bunch of sounds while he's talking and blah, blah, blah. Anyway, point being is, I think it's ingrained in us that if we make a mistake, we almost have to point it out first, because if we let someone else point it out, it's almost like we either don't care enough or we're not paying attention enough. And so I kind of carried that into podcasting at first, and I've had enough people tell me to quit that I think I've finally deprogrammed myself. Well, maybe not. I guess I just did it. But anyway, it's because if you come back to the debrief, if you and I fly together and I start doing the debrief, let's say, and there's something gross that I don't bring up, and you're like, hey, Jello, then you did this. And I say, I didn't want to talk about it. I mean, it's unprofessional.
Yeah. Oh, no. And of course, if you do that in a red flag scenario, you're going to get crucified by red air when they say, stop, you know, Eagle so-and-so, you know, we're 2.5 miles at your 6. You don't even see us. What the hell? And you come back with, oh, we didn't care about you. No, that's not. Oh, yeah. You got to own up to it.
Yeah. And that's the only thing worse than not bringing it up first is then when somebody does, blowing it off. Yeah. And again, just like anything in life, there are people that do it better than others. But anyway, I've been rambling for 30 minutes here, and I'm guessing people want to know about your shoot down. So let me ask you this. Where were you in August 1991? No, August 1990.
So in August 1990, I was at Gulfport, Mississippi.
Okay.
I was leading a detachment of 6 F-15s against the Missouri Guard, who were getting ready to retire their F-4s and then eventually receive the F-15.
Okay.
And so we were fighting for a week. And the last day, I want to say it was a Thursday. There was this big, huge blowout planned for that evening. We went out and did a 6V, I want to say 14. It could have been 16, but we smoked them. There wasn't a single one left. And they're like going, damn, you know, this F-15 is badass, and we're glad we're getting it.
And I got to interrupt, but this is in the day of Sparrows, right?
We had AMRAMs already in the C right. model. We were the first squadron to fly them. But we were flying both a combination. You know, we built it up. So we did some heaters and guns exercises. Then we did, all aspect. We didn't have AIM-9X, so we were still in the dinosaur era of an IR missile. And then the last day we were shooting AMRAMs. So it was an unfair fight the way it should have been. Mm-hmm. And so as we got back and we're coming back up initial, I get a call from the top three on the desk. And he says, hey, Rico, I need to talk to you when you shut down. And he says, tell everybody not to open a beer. And I go, okay. So I pass it on to the guys and said, okay, something's going on. But we get down, we land. The top three says, hey, the squadron wants you to put the jets back on, take the jets back to Eglin tonight. So we need to pack up, get everybody out of here. And then we'll get everybody home tomorrow once we get you guys out of here. So I called back to Eglin and I talked to the Eglin guys. They said, yeah, bring it on in. And they just said, hey, make sure you do not fill up the wing tanks, because we were carrying wing tanks for this deployment. Don't fill the wing tanks, just stay the internal fuel only. And then and when you get back and you land, we'll tell you where you're going to go park. It won't be normal parking. Interesting. So sure enough, we'd land about 7:30, 8 o'clock at night. And the entire ramp was lit up with light alls and everything you can imagine. Weapons trucks were flying left and right, delivering live weapons to the jets. Wow. And so we were loading the jets to go to respond to the Iraqi invasion.
Okay.
So that's where we were in August. You know, my daughter was born in July.
Oh, geez.
Yeah. So. And by the end of the month, we were on the road headed to Desert Shield.
Did you fly one of the birds over?
I did.
Okay.
Well, the first jet that I was flying over about 200 to 300 miles east of Charleston I developed an engine fire and had to take it into Langley.
Oh, gosh.
So flew the jet back to Langley with my wingman. 2 days later, they swapped the engine out. I flew it back to Eglin. And then 7 days after that, flew with the second group of guys to Saudi Arabia.
Okay.
And flew jets into there.
What was the longest single flight you had in that whole thing?
The actual from Eglin to Saudi Arabia to Tobruk, Saudi Arabia was 19 hours. We had 12 air refuelings. We had to go we didn't get to go north over Europe. We had to go straight from Charleston to the Straits of Gibraltar because of a big, huge hurricane in the North Atlantic.
Oh, my gosh. Were you in the seat for 19 hours?
Oh, I was in the seat for 22 hours. I was in the seat for almost an hour and a half before we pulled chocks. In the seat at Tobruk for almost an hour until they got to my jet to shut it down, because what we found out was in the shutdown process, the guys had lost all real physical motion of their legs. They were just numb.
Yeah.
And so, so we were holding the jets on one engine until you had an entire crew, and they would bring two stands to the jet, and then two people picked you up and they held you until you had enough blood flowing up and down your legs so that you didn't fall down and come tumbling off out of the canopy rope.
Okay, we could spend an hour on this and I won't, but oh my heavens. Because I don't know if you know Terry Scott, call sign Stretch. He might have been after
I know time. Stretch very well.
Oh, do you? Okay. So we talked about this on his F-22 episode on the show because someone had asked about it. I've never done a cross Pacific or Atlantic flight. My longest flight, 6.5 hours, and you did that 3 or 4 times over. But I can't imagine what your body goes through, what your brain goes through, how many piddle packs you had and empty PB&J wrappers. And let's not get into either one of those, but holy smokes. Okay, so you had a couple of days to acclimate, and then you guys start flying Desert Storm patrols, I assume.
No, Desert Shield.
Desert Shield, thank you. Yeah, I knew it was wrong. You said, I think earlier, January 19th, let's talk about 16 through 18. Are you flying patrol missions the first few nights of the war?
Yeah, so for us, the night of the 16th in the region, I flew the last 4 ship that was Desert Shield.
Oh, wow.
Okay, and so we took off, and basically we had a lot of what I would call cat and mouse type of runs to see if anybody was awake.
Okay.
We were checking, you know, to see if anybody, if the Iraqis were doing anything. Were they doing anything out of the normal that our sensors could pick up? So we did that. And the normal, you know, 6 or 7 o'clock in the evening, we are, you know, checking out and headed north or headed west back to our base. And again, not trying to elevate or raise any awareness. You know, and so by that time, a lot of the airplanes had already started to launch to the south, and then they were headed to the refueling tracks for the eventual night one push.
Okay. Yeah, we had Mark Hacera on the show recently, Sluggo. I don't know if you know him, but I think he was instrumental in a lot of the tanker plans there. So when you said that, it rung a bell. Okay. So what, a couple days of DCA or I don't know, OCA, I don't know what you were doing, but just briefly, and then I'd like to talk about the three events, if you're willing.
Yeah. So, the first few days, it was really from, I was on a DCA rotation. On the morning of the 17th, that day I flew 3 times, on the 18th, I flew 3 times,
How long was each flight? Sorry.
Averaging about 6 to 8 hours.
Total or per flight?
Total.
Oh, okay.
Per sortie. Yeah.
Wait, hold on. So you did 3 6-hour sorties?
Yeah. So we would take off, do our mission, come back and land, take off and do our second mission, then go sit alert, which was almost in the early phases of the war, alert was a guaranteed third sortie. So, it was pretty brutal. In the sense of the human ops tempo that we were going through.
Did you know an F-35 fighter jet is made up of approximately 50,000 fasteners? High-strength nuts, bolts, washers, rivets, and other aviation-grade fasteners are also used on spacecraft, race cars, and even do-it-yourself projects by hobbyists. If your next project at work or at home calls for mil-spec aerospace hardware, look to DNL Components Incorporated. DNL Components consults space manufacturers, engineering companies, and high-tech startups on hardware availability, application, and alternatives that may lower cost or be more readily available without compromising quality. DNL Components sources alloy steel, A286, titanium, Inco 718, and other Krez materials for bolts, washers, nuts, rivets, Hilox, hydraulic fittings, and more, or they can custom machine when you submit your prints and specs. Go to dnlcomponents.com to learn more and to schedule a consultation with Donnie or Larry. That's dnlcomponents.com. In case I forget to ask later, how many hours did you end up with in the military, let's say, for starters?
Oh, the military was about 3,600 hours.
How about in the Eagle?
In the Eagle, just a little over 1,500 hours.
Okay. Well, that sounds like it all came in a concentrated point of time, but anyway.
Yeah, the majority of my hours are definitely as a guerrilla.
Yeah. All right. So you started talking about the morning of the 19th.
Yeah. So the we took off like at 4 a.m. It was initially, that vol period was started at 6 a.m. So took off, hit the tankers, took over relief of the cap. We did about 2 hours of cap time. And then AWACS called us up and said, hey, you guys, the OCA for this strike package that's being picked up is stuck on the ground. They were Langley birds. They were weathered out. Mm. And so so AWACS asked us, they came up and said, hey, the new OCA is scrambling out of Tobruk, and they're asking for you to send a two-ship to the tanker to be ready to be the post-strike sweep. So I sent 3 and 4 first to the tanker to get as much gas as they could, and they would manage the DCA cap. And then Craig Underhill and I took, after they got back on station, we went to the tanker and started, refueling and then getting on frequency with the new strike package and what they were going to do. And this strike package, outside of the ATO, they had found a large munition storage area southwest of Baghdad, about 60 or 70 miles. And they had been tracking some vehicles going underground and all that. So they said, okay, it wasn't on a normal target list. So they scrambled all the strikers, air-to-air, harm shooters, you name it. They were all part of the strike package. And so we were going to be the two-ship post-strike sweep for this event. And then it just so happened that Rick Delaney's four-ship was the one who was on alert. They scrambled. Rick and I, obviously we're in the same squadron. We have the same squadron standard. So the basic briefing was everything is standard. Nice. And off we went. When the strike package pushed, Rick Delaney's four-ship engaged a series of MiGs and one F1, two MiG-31s and an F1 it was the final count that we had. AWACS at some points tended to think that there was more in the air, but that was really all that we had radar data on. Mm-hmm. Rick and Cherry Pitts end up scoring two kills in that group. The F1 that kind of cut through the formation and then dove into the clouds below the where the guys were flying. We never targeted him again. Nobody ever saw him again.
Okay.
Bottom line is Rick and his four-ship had jettisoned all their fuel tanks, and they never made it to the target area.
Oh.
So strike leader said, we're going to press anyway. And it made sense. They were also carrying air-to-air AMRAMs with the F-16s. But at the time, once we got that word, Mole and I pushed it up into the high 50s. And pushed out in front of the strike package to get caught up with them and then get out in front of them. And as we were getting out in front of them, we started to build a radar picture that had one group way out to the west which really wasn't a factor per se. And then one group that was starting to generate outside of Baghdad and came on a direct vector towards the leading edge of the strike package. So that's the group that we pretty much focused our attention on.
Yeah. Hey, can I interrupt? You said MiG-31. Did you mean 23 or 25? I don't think Iraq had MiG-31.
No, excuse me, 25s. 25s.
Okay, I thought so. Yeah. Very similar, yeah. but okay. Anyway, up until this point, had there been other kills? So the flight right ahead of you got two. What about like on the opening night or two or three of the war? Were other guys getting kills? Was it fairly common or fairly rare still?
No, I would say, so opening night, JB Kelk scored a kill. We had three kills in our squadron on opening night.
Wow.
And then Langley had one kill on opening night. Okay. So there was a total of four that were credited on opening night. Now, day two, Sly McGill and Rory Drager scored air-to-air kills. And then so here we are going into day three. And so we get two ship first, and then Mole and I will eventually get two more that day. Wow. So there was definitely opportunity. But when you think about it, you count all the F-15 and all the air-to-air shooter noses that were in the AOR, probably felt like a very limited opportunity for most folks.
Yeah. Yeah. And everybody, I mean, I don't know, not to go off script too much, but it's not like you want to take a life, right? Or you're not hoping for this to happen, but if it's going to happen, you want to be part of it because this is what we train to do.
Yeah. I mean, you hit the nail on the head. That's what we train to do.
Yeah.
And I can tell you that in the act of preparing, master arm hot, all that kind of stuff, that felt as common as a good tactical sim or a good run to at Nellis. Everything was what I call what we had trained to do. It's the post-kill activities syndrome thing that I call, where every once in a while I just wake up in a dead sweat and I'm sitting there going, holy smokes, you know, it could have been me.
Yeah.
If I had done this, you know, I would have been there.
Right.
And so it comes back to you in different stages of your life.
Oh, yeah.
But while you're there, it felt just like a normal training session.
Yeah. Okay. I didn't mean to detract from the story there.
No, no problem. So Mole and I, we concentrate our efforts on the MiG-29s. We don't know they're MiG-29s at the point, but they're coming out of Baghdad. But what becomes very clear in what they end up doing, they come at us in a res cell, i.e. we can't break them out on the radar, a very tight formation. When they start to break out of their res cell into a tactical formation, so now they're flying about a mile a line abreast, they take it down. They start out around 8,000 to 10,000 feet. They take it down. We're still now in the high 30s. We're ramping down from 50 to 30. They take it down. At exactly 12 nautical miles, boom, they take a beam maneuver, which for those who are on the call, that was a known, not a publicly known, but it was a known tactical deficiency in our radar that we had some blind zones. And they hit the blind zones exactly, you know, on the number.
Oh, wow.
And so Mole and I break lock. We knew what to do. We start to pick them up as they're in their beam maneuver. And then as they're in their beam maneuver and they start their drag, they literally are dragging right outside, initially right outside of the ragged edge of an AIM-7 shot,
okay,
a Sparrow shot. Okay. But as we're ramping down, we're starting to, you know, pull them into the WES. But as you well know, with a Sparrow, you got to hold the missile until impact. It's not like an AMRAM,
right,
which you can shoot and launch and leave. And so literally as the MiGs are starting to, they're in the heart of the envelope for a Sparrow, period, dot. I hear the strike package leader call Miller time, which was the code for the last guy is down the chute. Okay. And then I'm getting ready to hit the button for Mole and I to abort when my original Western AWACS controller calls out on guard Citgo pop-up contacts 3304 8. So mathematically, I've got two MiG-29s dragging in front of me at about 11 miles, and they don't have opening V-sub-C, but I can catch them if I want to. Mm-hmm. But I also know that I'm also going to now enter into the MEZ for Baghdad.
Okay.
The strike package has done their business, so I really don't need to be here anymore. And now, off of my left 9 o'clock, which is 330 for my formation, 8 miles, my original AWACS controller says, somebody is there that you don't want to be there. So immediately I turn hard left to 330. I don't remember. This is now habit patterns taken over. I don't remember reaching down and jettisoning my fuel tanks. But when I jettison my fuel tanks and I turn to 330, I generate a huge con around my jet, which my wingman, who's 2.5 miles off my right wing, when he's looking now to the west to 330, he sees three fuel tanks flying off my jet. He sees a big, huge con ball. And he's like going, oh my God, Rico just get hit. As I roll out to 330, I take the F-15's auto gun system, throw it out of the 330 heading, and immediately I get a lock, and it's at 8 miles.
That's correlation.
The good news is I've got good correlation, and I've got some radar essay as to what's there. The bad news is the rules of engagement that we had still at that point in Desert Storm required anything inside of 10 miles to be visually identified. Why did we have that in the rules of engagement? The rules of engagement were written for all of the platforms that were in the AOR to include the 117. At night, in certain scenarios, we could have found them. We wouldn't have known it was them. So that rule of engagement was put in place for protection.
Okay.
It didn't have a clause that said day or night. It just said the rule was if you get an auto gun system lock inside of 10 miles, you got a VID. So we're kind of stuck between a rock and a hard spot.
Yeah.
And did not opt to wing it and take a BVR shot, even though I was carrying a MiG-29 spike on my RWR. And I had not completed my ID matrix, so I had no idea of mode 1, mode 2, mode 4, or anything else.
The spike you were talking about is coming from the 330 bearing?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. And then just for everyone who might be listening later, the mode 1, 2, and 4 you're talking about are the different transponder settings, if you will, of an IFF. And that's a whole, we haven't even touched on that here on the show yet, but different ways to identify friend or foe, as IFF stands for. Okay. So are you wearing night vision goggles?
No, this is now the middle of the day. And we didn't have goggles at the time.
You didn't anyway?
We took off at night, but it's now
gotcha.
Approaching, you know, like 10:30 in the morning.
Okay. All right.
So when I get spiked, I give as much radar data to my wingman verbally, and then I do a beam notch, if you will. I roll inverted, pull straight down to the dirt, and I am pointing straight at the ground. My goal there is, one, to get below the radar plane of motion of the MiG-29, mm-hmm. so I can start becoming part of the ground clutter. I start pumping out a bunch of chaff to try and decoy my airplane, so the MiG has a hard time looking at me. It's not a hard solution for his airplane because he's got a blue sky background. So I got to make it hard for him. He's at 8,000 feet, so I'm passing through 35 and screaming straight at the dirt. And then as I'm starting my level off, you know, I start the level off about 2,000 or 3,000 feet, and eventually get down to about 500 feet on the deck. But now the spike continues to follow my airplane off my right wing. So I, at least I know it's on the right wing somewhere, mm-hmm. but I just can't find this guy. And I am doing the funky chicken in the cockpit, trying to find this guy in the sky where, as you remember at Top Gun, you would say, hey, don't scan this guy, look in one spot, look for some contrast, and then you'll pick up the early tally-ho. If I had a go camera on my head at that point, it would have looked like the spinning top going crazy trying to find this guy, because the audio of the MiG-29 was obviously getting tighter and tighter. What I didn't know at the time, obviously, while I was flying, was that our total package team, the EC-130 team, was aware of what had just happened, and they were on his frequency, and they were jamming the piss out of him. So he was getting both radar jamming and audio jamming, which complicated, you know, his eventual shoot solution. When I hear my wingman confirm he's completed the ID matrix, Rivet Joint gives him a declaration also that it's a MiG-29 hostile. At the time, I'm still going straight downhill when Mole calls Fox 3. So when I look up over my shoulder at high 7, I see his missile come off his airplane, start to generate a huge smoke trail. And the smoke trail is trailing across my tails, pointing to my right 3 o'clock. Completely out of the wild blue, as I see his missile stop smoking, I use that little pencil beam of smoke and follow the line. And boom, I pick up a MiG-29, the silhouette pointing straight at me, about 3 to 3.5 miles off my right wing. He's pure pursuing me the whole way. And then next thing I know, boom, big, huge sparkler in the sky, Mole's missile hits that MiG-29 smack in the nose. I don't know if you've seen the pictures that are out there, but there's several pictures of the HUD field of view. They were recovered by some special ops guys. And the HUD field of view shows the AIM-7 Sparrow, the rods of the AIM-7 expanding literally, you know, feet in front of the HUD. So you know what's coming. It's just going to rip that airplane to pieces.
I have seen a picture like that. Truthfully, I never believed it. So you're saying that's real, huh?
Oh, yeah, very real.
Wow, okay. Well, yeah. I believe you. All right, so that was one MiG-29. Was there more than one, I take it?
Yeah, so at that point, I am at 500 feet. Mole is about 25,000 feet. We're both kind of going same way, same day, on a westerly kind of heading. And then again, Boner comes up on guard and says, Sitco, second group, north 10. So at that point, I go, if I get the math wrong, that puts the guy 7 miles at my tail if I check to south. So I, boom, check the formation to north, and we both get a hit right at about 10 nautical miles on our radar scope. We both start to do the ID matrix. I get a hostile indication when I complete my ID matrix. My wingman gets a friendly. As it turns out, he actually has friendlies, because as high as he is, he's got friendlies way beyond the radar line of sight. Mm-hmm. So he's getting an error that is conservative, which is the right thing. Right. For me, I'm looking purely at the beam, looking up, and I don't have anything in the background. So that was the lesson learned in the debrief. Why did this happen like this? But the end result was I had one friendly declaration. I had one hostile. I declared myself as the eyeball on a shooter eye formation. And then so at about 4.5 miles, I started to do a pure pursuit from 5,000 feet to 8,000 feet, put the MiG-29 on the TD box. And the first time I could see him visually, because that was really now the requirement, he looked like a F-18. He looked like an F-15. He looked like everything that we flew, because I couldn't see the background, of the color background. Mm-hmm. So as it turns out, I continue my lead pursuit on him. I cross about 50 feet off of his left wing at a very high angle of it. I'm doing about 120 degrees nose up, and he's pretty much wings level. When I cross him right there, it's the first time I see the Iraqi flag and the brown and green camouflage, and I call, you know, hostile back, MiG-29.
Wow.
Then I start a hard left turn, climbing left turn, from where I was coming from. And when I look over my shoulder, he has started a level turn right on the horizon, hasn't changed his plane of motion. I don't know if he sees my wingman. So when I see that he starts a level turn, I literally flip the airplane, roll inverted, and do a split S to the inside of the circle to now meet him at the first 180 with a 90-degree heading crossing angle. So I've already gained 90 degrees of angles on him. And then he still doesn't see me, or at least he's not responding to me. So I'm on the outside of his circle. I pull for everything that the Eagle has. And I probably think there was more. But when we got home, I had several pulls on the airplane in excess of 10 Gs on this particular fight. But I pulled to the inside of the circle. And when I cross his extended tail and now get to the inside of the circle, I still have over 200 knots of closure on him. So he's not flying a very aggressive jet, but that's the first time he puts his lift vector on my jet and starts to turn in my direction. So I know now that he's aware. At this point, my wingman has sanitized the airspace around us. And he actually has a short window to say, "Hey, Rico, I can come in," and I just go, "Stand by."
You got yours.
Yeah. You got yours on this. So yeah, that fight starts to, obviously deteriorate closer and closer to the ground. We do 2 360s from about 6,000 feet to about 1,000 feet AGL. At about 1,000 feet AGL, I pull to the inside of the circle to try and get one, what I call really hard of the envelope AIM-7 Sparrow shot, just to bring the ASC circle in and take that shot. Other people have told me, and I believe it, when you're in an Eagle and, you're inside of 2,000 to 3,000 feet and you pull that much lead, it literally looks like you're going for a gunshot. So he's at about 800 to 600 feet. He rolls inverted and starts the classic split S, or what I thought was going to be the MiG-29 Cobra maneuver. When he rolls inverted, I was not going to follow him through that point because I can already sense that what I see in the desert, these aren't, big trees. These are little bushes, and the bushes are getting big. So I pull a quarter plane to the high six of the MiG-29, roll inverted, start to put my nose back into him. And he literally hasn't even hit perpendicular. His afterburners are now cooking. They weren't cooking before. And he hits the desert floor and starts to tumble for what seems to be, several miles of maneuvering from there.
Wow.
And so very quickly after that, my wingman comes up and says, "Hey, tactical right side." So I look off to my right side, and sure enough, at 2 miles, there he is. And then we snap to south and we start to get the hell out of Dodge.
Wow. Well, good on starting at the end, good on your wingman for being right where he's supposed to be after all that. That's crazy. I do want to touch on the ambiguity of the visuals of the MiG-29, because I used to be the threat aircraft SME at Top Gun in the early 2000s, right before the flanker became the percentage threat. It was the MiG-29. And that was one of the things I used to talk about, is you've got the twin vertical stabilizers, a lot like an Eagle, but you've got the size, you've got the leading edge extensions of an F-18. So it really was very ambiguous, frankly. And Rico, I can't tell you how many VIDs I did over my career in training. You really did a no-kidding standby, and you called the fin flash. That's amazing to me.
Yeah.
And then you were in a dogfight. Wow. All right. And then you didn't have to employ any weapons. You get the kill here. I take it there was no effort for ejection. Was he probably looking over his shoulder at you, maybe?
Yeah, there was no attempt for an ejection. It was very clear. He was a little bit of misorientation, but he had no real recovery for the jet, for the square corner that he had put himself into.
Wow.
When we did our check-in with ops back home, AWACS had already called in that we had the first two ship had two kills and we had two kills. And so we were coming back, and then I call in that the only expenditures I had was fuel tanks. And then my crew chief's like going, "Well, they obviously got something wrong." And I go, "Well, it's a little different than the standard, mission, but we did get two kills."
So, yeah.
He was a very proud crew chief to put that first green star on the jet.
I'm sure. So Rico, this is the part where I always, again, I mean, I don't know. It was a human life, and I get that. And I'm not trying to say you should feel bad, but I'm just curious, what did go through your mind when, maybe not the moment you saw it, because at that point you're like, okay, this fight's over, and I'm glad I didn't follow his maneuver. But as you're leaving, are you exhilarated? Are you a little verklempt? I mean, what goes through your mind?
So physiologically, I can tell you that I experience a very, very weird syndrome when I get this level of adrenaline running through my body, because it's the only thing the doctors can say can cause this. Once it's over, once you're starting to recover, you're flying wings level, you're starting to lower your heart rate, you're starting to lower your breathing. For me, my body starts to go through a series of convulsions, and you know, again, if I had a Go camera, it would have looked like a 7.5 earthquake inside the cockpit.
A seizure.
A seizure type of thing.
Yeah.
And so the first time, this particular time, I had never experienced it before, never experienced it in any of my other, you know, dealings of what I call high adrenaline, high rush things. So I was in a complete loss. As a matter of fact, my wingman thinks that I am set, you know, in the F-15, if you porpoise the airplane, it means to move further and further away. And he's looking at my airplane doing this up and down. And he's like going, man, what's he really mean? And I'm really just trying to hold on to the airplane until I could physically let go of the stick and the throttle, reach up and grab what we call in the F-15, the towel racks, and hold on to that and just let it ride this out. And that lasted for probably a good 3 or 4 minutes.
Really?
And I just, you know, I wasn't sure what it was. By that time, my tape had already run out, so I couldn't tell the doc, hey, this is what was going on, anything.
Yeah.
And so I talked to the doc, and he goes, hey, I think it's just, adrenaline rush. Let's get you some sleep. Let's get you a horse pill so you can literally find your first 6 hours of sleep. And then, you know, we'll get you back into the airplane and start flying again. And that's kind of where I ended up. But that was the physiology that occurred to me.
Yeah.
In my next events, I learned, and I knew exactly when it started to trigger. I wanted to be wings level. I hit autopilot on, and I grabbed onto the handles, and I rode it out in the other two events.
I've had something similar. It was a result of a night trap on a carrier in Pitching Decks. It's been chronicled on the PBS carrier special, and I've talked about it here on the show before, but it was pretty harrowing, not quite like you had, but still life-threatening. And with the Eagle is you taxi on the ground with your rudder pedals and the brakes are at the top. Well, for us, we're doing very fine positioning to try to park our aircraft, and it's pitch dark. Can't barely see anything, but the director's wands. And same thing. I think the human body, I'm no physiologist, but I think it uses the big muscles. So the big core muscles in your thighs to get rid of that adrenaline. So my legs were literally just shaking as much as could be. And I'm trying to finely tune this aircraft into a parking spot. And I just remember like, what is this? Because at that point I wasn't afraid anymore. So I was more perplexed by what is this? And then I realized later, okay, that's the adrenaline my body was using. And now it needs to get rid of it. And so it's interesting what you said that, and we'll get there, I suppose, but so on the second and the third, was it less or was it still there, but at least you were familiar or?
Yeah, it was the exact same, scenario. And, when people listen to our tapes from the first one to the second one, the second one, many of the guys, who would listen to the tape said, you sounded way too calm and relaxed for the fact that you were in combat and you're getting ready to shoot down, some MiG-23s. And I tell the audience, I go, well, let me set the scene. You know, number one and number three, myself and Rory, we both had an air-to-air kill already. Kimo Schiavi, number two, that was his first one. And if you would have watched his radar tape and listen to his intracom for his tape, he was in high PRF, hyperventilation mode. Rory and I were sitting back, lighting a Lucky with our feet up, just la, la, la. But internally, if they'd have had Fitbits back then, they would have blown up with the amount of, with the heart rates and all that everybody was experiencing.
Well, let's think about this for a second. In Vietnam, we had a couple aces, at least one in the Air Force, one in the Navy that I can think of, or off the top of my head, maybe more. In World War II, obviously tons. In Korea, I guess some. I'm not a Korean War student, but in the 90s and today, certainly, it's very rare to get a kill. I mean, we've only just finally had a kill in the Navy for the first time since Desert Storm. Yep. And so once you've done it, then the next thing would be to become an ace and to have five. And that's almost unheard of. And so for you guys, it's like, okay, no matter what, short of getting shot down, right? I've been there, done that. The likelihood of becoming an ace is not as big a deal. Whereas for the other gentleman whose name I already forgot, this is his chance, right, to go from zero, which everybody is, to one, which is an exclusive club. So, of course, he's going to have a little bit of buck fever, I think.
No, you hit the nail on the head. But the real truth is the advancements that we have made in air-to-air combat, especially in the capabilities that both the radar and the AMRAAM have today, tactically speaking, you know, you could put a two-ship of Raptors in the sky or any of our airplanes in the sky, and they could come out. You know, a Raptor could put eight in the air, and an F-15C can put eight in the air. You could come out of there shooting eight missiles and killing eight targets.
Theoretically.
Mm-hmm. And so the mathematical probability of becoming an ace is actually higher today.
True.
It's just that the environment that we're in is very, as much as different.
Yeah.
And of course, you know, the counter technology, whether it be electronic warfare, ECCM, all that, you know, plays into it. And it's well documented. There are quite a few folks from the Desert Storm era, especially, who forgot to do Master Arm Hot, and their window of opportunity between in the zone and now, you know, missed shot is fleeting seconds. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, they will remember Desert Storm from the standpoint of, I forgot to go Master Arm Hot. And so that happens too.
Yeah. Which is, I don't know, for me, that would eat me up in my life because I would constantly beat myself up about it. I would. I mean, yeah, I might be more disappointed about that than other outcomes of air combat. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, I agree with you.
So you come back. What's it? I mean, when you guys come back into the overhead, are you faster than normal, lower than normal, or are you just kind of, hey, this is what we do and we did it? And I mean, was there a lot of celebration and jubilation, or is it kind of another day?
There wasn't a lot of celebration because the bottom line was it was another day coming. You knew that you were going to be flying in not too many hours again. But yeah, so my wingman and I, we had this chat a couple hundred miles out, and I said, Somo, what do you think? He goes, this is when we're allowed to do an aileron roll, right? And I go, well, that's kind of the way they did it in Vietnam, so let's do it. So we came in normal speed, normal, you know, overhead speed for us. But just as we hit, right before you, before the wheels would touch down, you know, I plugged in the burners. I was pretty light as it was already, you know, got the nose jacked up 30 degrees, started to accelerate, did an aileron roll, and then pitched back out. Needless to say, we both got our asses chewed. my boots were not very shiny when the wing commander came out and ripped me a new one. So he got me for my boots. He got me for my aileron roll. And I think he also got me for the fact that I hadn't shaved in 3 days because I hadn't seen a razor in 3 days. So
he was also insanely jealous. I'm just going to say right now, because he wasn't, were you a captain or a major at this point?
A captain.
Okay. So he wasn't a captain anymore, which is young and fearless. He wasn't flying all these missions. He might've flown one or two occasionally and he didn't get a kill. So I'll just exonerate you on his behalf, if I may. All right. So this was the 19th. I forget what you said, 21st. So a couple days later?
26.
26. Okay. A week later.
Yeah. So it's exactly a week later.
You're flying all week, right?
Flying all week. And so actually I'm flying 114 again. Okay. And that's why she has her two stars.
Excellent.
And so this day is a terrible weather day.
Well, I hate to cut it off, but that's all the time we have for this week. Who am I kidding? We have plenty of time, but come on. For the price of a fancy couple Starbucks drinks or a short Uber ride, you could help support the show and hear the rest of this exciting discussion with Rico. You'll hear all about his second MIG kill, which he uses weapons this time, as well as his third, and more importantly, how these experiences really changed him as a human. I mean, the response he got from some of his fellow pilots wasn't always very complimentary or flattering. A lot of envy involved, frankly, and he really does use these experiences both in his personal life and his business, and it's just a really great discussion. So would you please consider heading on over to patreon.com patreon.com, patreon.com, and search for the Fighter Pilot Podcast. And for a relatively small amount, you can help support the show, gain access to this and about a dozen other really great happy hour discussions. And it's the season, and you love the show, so why not? Help us out. Anyway, let me just remind you that the views expressed in this presentation are the personal views of myself and Rico and do not necessarily represent the position of the Department of Defense or any of its components. Anyway, happy holidays to you. Take care of yourselves, and we'll see you here next time on the Fighter Pilot Podcast. So long. Thanks to our title sponsor, National University. National University is committed to supporting veterans, active duty personnel, and military families through flexible online courses and master's and doctoral programs in high-demand fields, providing excellent career advancement opportunity. National University is a yellow ribbon school that proudly accepts the post-9/11 GI Bill and goes the extra mile by offering additional assistance to cover expenses that may not be covered by the GI Bill. To learn more, visit nu.edu/veteran.